Hey there, Static Nation. Thank you for listening. I want to take care of a little bit of business before getting into this episode. First, I want to invite you to leave me a voicemail. If you love this cyberpunk epic, if you have questions about where it's going or anything whatsoever, go to anchor.fm/staticcore, and that's CORPS, anchor.fm/staticcore, and you can leave me a voicemail. I'll do my best to respond to whatever messages I get. Second, I want to invite you to check out my other podcast. It's real life storytelling. It's an exploration of everything from inner places to outer spaces. I talk about my journey as a person with atypical neurology. I speak to artists, musicians, restaurant owners, people who make knives, and people who are making a difference in the community. A little bit of everything that is interesting to me and hopefully interesting to you. Control, Alt, Delete, and Reset. First-hand account, Part 5, provided by General J.Q. Blackburn for the purposes of aiding in the Static Core and Cooperative's internal affairs investigation. I have no new formal complaints, and for the sake of brevity, I will not rehash any of the old ones. I would like to start with some thank yous. First, thanks to the Army of the Undead, 100% of whom have submitted their accounts to the investigators, making it clear that they were not paid mercenaries. Our total excommunication from the co-op looks very unlikely at this point. However, we could still face permanent decommission from the Corps. Thanks to everyone who has reaffirmed their commitment to using the Corpsman's Code of Conduct and the Doom Trooper's Guide. We understand that in some ways this has exacerbated the conflict between Unit 2 Plus and those who wish to go back to the old standards. Finally, thanks to everyone who's made their way back to Region 1. There's a long way to go before operations are back to 100%, but they're on their way. I have a request I've received multiple times that I can address as I continue my account. Who is Tardata Tech, and what do they make? For those of you searching for the company, the spelling is TARDADATEXH. If you find a Tardata Tech spelled with a TECH, different company altogether. They were one of the original 12 banded companies, those listed when the World Economic Ban first went live. Their primary revenue source was communications hardware. Tardata did everything from big infrastructure pieces like satellites and long transmission lines between cities, down to small things like media capture devices and nanoscale transceivers that internal medical systems use to communicate. For decades, Tardata was one of the top three companies. They managed more than 24 cities, including most of those in the southeast. But about 15 years ago, they started slipping. I'm not going to turn this into a dissertation on the rise and fall of Tardata Tech. The short version of the story is that they fell from global leadership primarily because they failed to adapt to changing technology developed by Syngas, which made most of the communications hardware obsolete. They sunk everything into making Miami a Class 5 city, which was supposed to be their power play for climbing back into the top tier. That all ended when we drove a stake through the heart of their operations. Defense, arrest, reconnaissance, and quarantine is one of the most powerful companies in the world, but because of its structure, it barely registers on the web. For all intents and purposes, they are the police. They have some kind of presence in just about every city, no matter what company manages it. DARK is a blend of military and police. They have uniformed guards in public stations and perform many of the classic protect and serve efforts that police are known for. Their visible presence, however, is only about 10% of their operation. Two-thirds of their personnel are plainclothes or undercover operatives, and there are untold numbers of people who are sleepers, waiting to be activated, or whose information and passive observations are fed into their database. Dark has thousands of hidden bases peppered throughout cities, tucked in buildings and neighborhoods. If you find one, tag it. That's where I was being hauled off to when they thought I was a Tardata manager trying to run a hack on the company. They dosed me with a sedative that I was inoculated against, but I played dead. This is another instance where acting the part is critical. Had I shaken off the drug, they would have known I wasn't the average Joe, and that would have put them on high alert. So long as I was a low-level threat, they wouldn't take me to the bowels of their station, from which I might disappear totally. Looking at the data coming back from my signal searcher, I realized that I was very close to Tardata's secure specialty manufacturing facilities and couldn't pass up the opportunity to steal some of their hardware. While most of the tech on grid is junk, we like to snag as much of it as we can so we can catalog it and have hacks ready to go. Assuming command of a dark facility is an advanced tactic that requires use of a whole array of skills, suggestive routines, psycho tactics, live hacks, and who knows what else, depending on your target, your goal, what kind of station you're in. At that moment, my main thing was to snag a copy of the source data Tardata used to program their equipment, along with any design schematics. With it, we've been able to update our hacks and map their networks. Even though Tardata is dead, their hardware and software is still alive, and we've gobbled up enough information so whatever company ends up with that equipment will still have access. The arresting guards took me into an observation and interrogation room, one of my least favorite places, and since they thought they had a good read on me, they sent in recon guys to start the interrogation. Assuming command of a dark station is first and foremost an act of confidence. It doesn't matter how good your hacks are, what kind of suggestions you're pushing into people's IMS. If you don't command authority, they won't listen to you and none of it will work. Interrogators always work in pairs. As soon as they walked in the room, I sprang to my feet and started barking nonsense at them. I kept calling out my name, repeating their names, calling out my serial number, then reading theirs aloud, checking the chain of command name for name with them and making sure they confirmed it. While all of this is going on, I was running my field disruptor on low. Some people call this combination of tactics digital hypnosis. The end result is that instead of having to fight my way out of Tardata's holding room, I was escorted through the executive passages into the secure manufacturing areas. While on my guided tour, I was able to copy more data than I've had time to sort through, but more importantly, I skimmed billions of serial numbers, which have been able to locate and gain access to tons of hardware. Most importantly, from there, I was able to trigger a high-level security threat, which called for outside forces to be brought into the core of the Cityplex. This was only one step to keeping the ring roads open. But for it to work long enough to keep the roads moving, it would have to be backed up with something a little more dramatic. One of the flaws with a pseudo takeover like the one I used to get out of the dark room is that it has limited effect. If I had run into a real Tardata manager, somebody higher up the ladder, they could have ruined my game. I dismissed my escorts and sent them on fool's errands, but not before cloning their security passcode so I could get through the doors in the passages and back out of the building. Fake explosions are handy, and there are a variety of them, from the purely illusory, sonic-only flash fire. Again, it's about what you need to achieve your goal. To achieve what I needed, a straight illusion wouldn't cut it. I planned a sequence combining digital smoke and mirrors with some real heat. So not only could I get out of the building, but we could all get out of the city center. Exit, escape, and exodus. Whichever part of getting off grid you're working on, it's always about timing. I took a good look at my route out of the building, saw how many people would be trying to leave in an emergency, and checked the fire escape routes. I also had to recalculate my rate of travel with my prosthetic. I already knew Cakes was doing her thing on the roads from the green indicator around her name in my heads-up display. I also heard some of the commanders in the dark office shouting orders to get more drivers on the roads and to switch the traffic patterns and close the streets to try and slow things down and curtail the chase. Cam was also in the green. The vault had made it to the loading dock and was already hitched to go. They just needed to know the roads would remain open long enough for the convoy to get out. They were also working to keep Dark at bay and needed to get rolling. I had to keep pace with their work while I moved around slapping power patches at electrical nodes. These thin, pliable, adhesive electrical conductors that can be used to create a surge of electricity anywhere you want. Of course, they come with options like timers, remote detonation, or proximity triggers, and can be set to simply burn out something quietly, or as was my need at the time, to make an explosion. I know a lot of people have gotten a laugh out of seeing Tardata employees walking around, coughing and waving their hands around, trying to clear smoke that wasn't there. But remember that anything in the mind reads is real, and it could be you on the other side of some kind of mind hack. The explosion was very real, not very damaging. It knocked me clear out of the door, and I don't know how far I would have gone had I not slammed into that car. Before I could collect my marbles, a slick black coupe pulled up and I managed to stumble into an open door. That was the first time I met Dee Dee. As soon as I updated my status to the group as mobile with escape in progress, I got a ping back for assistance with road work. Lucky for them, Dee Dee was a class 1 driver, and her car was fully loaded with the hardware needed to run any game on the street. Fender bender is one of the most basic ways to manipulate traffic. Contact coding is a quick way to deliver hacks. Dee Dee cruised up behind cars and tapped them just hard enough to register the contact, which pushed a code that blew out the airbags and made the impact seem a lot worse. She did this to about a dozen cars, which triggered Dark to send in investigators along with tow trucks, another way to keep the roads moving. The second part of the core wasn't as easy to get out of. The traffic moved faster and they allowed larger commercial vehicles to move through the express lanes that divided the major blocks. Our main goal when we got there was to catch up to Cakes, who had already delayed her escape to wait for us. Oh yes, yield to emergency services is a system Dee Dee built herself. It broadcasts a similar signal to emergency services, which makes vehicles yield the lane. I'm working with her now to make it standard equipment on Moto Auto's Model 617. I watched in awe as she snaked through the streets, shifting from lane to lane, and when her way was blocked, she needed to cross an intersection or make a turn, she just hit the oh yes and the cars would part out of her way. Systems like this have been tried before, but they usually made the vehicle visible on grid and had to be kept on to work effectively. How she overcame these issues is proprietary. She hasn't even told me, so I don't know how it works, but nonetheless, I can't wait to see what you do with it. Finally, catching up to Cakes, she was playing capture and control, which takes two people. The navigator has to find an easy to hack car and take it over and uses it to open the road and act as a decoy. The driver just has to drive. Sliding up behind Cakes gave us options since two cars can run more codes and stunts. At this point, the plan was to stealth out to the third loop and slink back onto the service roads by pretending to be a convoy carrying hazardous materials. It was working too. We rode the express lanes right through the outermost section of Miami's core. We saw the fire trucks and military-style vehicles moving in to investigate the explosion and whatever else was happening back at Tardata headquarters. All of these maneuvers are disapproved by the Corpsman's Codex because they violate the Street Access Mitigation Agreement Unit 2 Plus put together with the Businessmen's Association. Apparently, they also gave them some means by which to identify both our rides and our signals on the street, a matter which will not go unresolved. I bring this up because it explains the problem we had getting off grid when we got to the third loop, and why we ended up causing a massive string of accidents on the ICE before making our escape. Cam was able to use the underground roads to bypass most of the trouble, and they were able to get right onto the third ring. Just before everything went to hell, we linked up with the rest of the team who had the vault in tow with a full complement of drivers from Blade and Cannon. I knew we were in trouble when the crossover gate failed to switch open, but we had another way out. We didn't have a chance to do anything but react because all the cars around us went black and started trying to run us off the road. I want to emphasize the trying part because between my team and the Cannon drivers, it turned into a tutorial on vehicular mayhem. The name of the game at that point was Get the Vault Off the Loop. We had to protect it at all costs. First order of business when involved in car-to-car assaults is to find out who's driving. On grid, people's cars can be taken over and used in pursuits. Dark runs, tons of vehicles with no badging. On the upside, they used empty cars. On the downside, it made them all more dangerous. It meant we didn't have to worry about hurting any innocent people. It's against the code to knowingly hurt non-combatants. And in the case of their injury, it's your responsibility to see that they are treated. On more than a few occasions, I've totaled out cars with people inside who had no idea what was going on. Not only did I have to take care of their medical expenses, but I also had to replace their vehicles. It was easy at first. The Cannon drivers huddled tightly around the SUV hauling the trailer, and when a dark car moved in, one of them would pop out and knock it away. Then Dee Dee or someone else would drive up and deliver a harder hit to send the car into the wall. This didn't last long. Dark sent cars two and three at a time as they got bigger, SUVs and trucks which were loaded with extra weight. It took two of our cars working in concert to take out these heavy rollers. One of the Cannon drivers allowed me to take remote control of his car to better facilitate maneuvers. It's not as simple as just slamming in the cars. The goal is to hit them in such a way they get crippled, spin out and flip, or eat it into a wall. Sandwich slams are generally good for twisting frames and slowing cars down. Checking a car into a wall is great, but even better if you can keep them pressed against the concrete and grind them down. Side swipes to the quarter panel have a good chance of cracking part of the suspension or busting a wheel clean off. Always look out for debris flying around on the road. Dark gave us a run. Two of the Cannon drivers went down. Dee Dee's driving kept us moving, but she took some serious hits. I didn't think my teeth would stop rattling after a couple of them. At one point, we were driving backwards for an extended period of time, during which Dee Dee pulled off a chain of pit maneuvers before getting hit by a rolling drone, which sent us spinning. Somehow, she pitched her ride to the perfect angle, so when we got hit, it sent us spinning into one car, which we ricocheted off of and then slammed into an SUV. When she regained control before hitting the wall, I almost lost it. I know it sounds like, and from the video it even looks like it was total madness, but it was graceful chaos. The last few moments of the pursuit can be the most dangerous. Even more so in a case someone had to take the hit to make sure the gate flipped open. We dropped all the fancy driving, fell into a straight line behind the vault. Even those few moments of vulnerability are all it takes to get wiped out. One of the blade drivers launched out ahead of the group and blasted right through the gate, busting it open. Cake stopped to help them so everyone else could keep rolling. Riding down a steep embankment and slipping into the underside of the city, it got dark fast. I still love that moment when the glass in a car lights up with a scanner. All the readings coming alive at one time. You're gonna spend a lot of time riding in the slip, also known as the zero. It's the space between the upper and lower parts of the city. Another machine area, but it's also used as a floodplain and as a transport area. It's pitch black for the most part. Another pro tip, make sure you tune the color and intensity of the scanner display in your car to something you can tolerate for long periods of time. There are pillars, buildings that cut through the zero, chasms, and all kinds of unseen dangers. You don't want tired eyes to cost you your life. Pulling back into Port of Miami, there were already more lights on than I could count. We did not coordinate any formal reactivation of the operations or services at Palm Bay. As I made clear earlier in this account, we arrived, tooled up, and rolled out. I am aware that some people disembarked with us in Miami, but I don't know what, if any, orders they had. It appeared to me that people were coming back on their own accord. The fact that the hospital was up and running and there was a full team of medical professionals on deck is not evidence of a planned reactivation of the site. Most of our facilities are based around medical services because of the danger of the work, and any high-ranking officer or operative or digit in the Corps has professional medical training. There are digits who won't even take a job if it's not within 10 minutes of an emergency room. Medical facilities are also considered protected sites by extranationals, so we keep a minimum of their tech on site to serve as a specialty treatment facility, particularly for people in stasis. Their protections are minor, but they're better than nothing. Instead of going to the hospital, we actually had a medical team head over to Blade and Cannon's vault, since 675's vault had to be opened in the bank security area. We also requested a special transport to take possession of the digital field map and wanted to hand it over in some place that could be locked down. I wish we had called for more backup or orderlies, maybe even a SWAT team, because things got hairy. Dryce, Marzell, Lance, and Carol weren't just suffering from exposure to bad space. They had removed significant portions of their memories as a safety measure. It's not an uncommon practice. When going into dangerous missions, if you get captured and they hack into your mind, there's no telling how bad the ramifications could be. It's not always easy to reintegrate memories for several reasons. How long they've been out of the head, nature of the content, the condition of the mind they're going back into. The medical team went to work quickly and found themselves in trouble. They followed the procedures to the letter. Get consent from the patient, sedate, confirm authenticity and integrity of the memory storage device and the mind it's going into. This was all happening simultaneously with all four of them. And that last part is when things went off the rails. Despite being fully sedated, at about the same moment, Marzell and the rest of 675 came to in a rage. They didn't even bother taking off the headgear or pulling out the IVs. They just started swinging at medics. All of their internal defensive and offensive augments kicked in, and they were throwing people and equipment like they were stuffed animals. I jumped in to help, and Dryce tossed me into a wall. More people came in to help, and eventually we got them under control and restrained. At some point during their misadventures in Tardata Tech, they had been infected with a nanopsychotic virus. You don't treat psychoviruses in a traditional sense because they're carried by nanites, not natural or even genetically modified viruses. They can kill, they can also burn out neurons. This is another instance where internal medical systems save lives, more specifically the virtual interface. The two most common uses for these viruses are turning someone into a drone that gathers intel and reports it back, or making them into a Trojan horse, which can do anything from sabotage to being an active sleeper agent working meticulously to undermine an organization or operation. As we saw at that moment, they were just trying to rip the room apart and cracking heads. Treatment requires at least two people. Monaco and I jumped in to help Marzell. I wish it was as simple as getting into whatever hallucination or psychosis they were dealing with and shaking them out of it, or purging the nanites from the brain. Monaco's job was to interpret the data coming from the nanites, so I have a map to target the right ones. Had I started wiping out the critters blindly, it could have shut down Monaco's organ systems or fried her brain. Before, when I used the virtual medical interface to fish out the shards of spikes from the spikes in the wall, the ones that were cutting their way through my body, there was a physical environment to be interpreted, which made the work a lot easier. This was a much trickier situation, since working in the brain is very different. Add to that, to interface with nanoviruses means working at the speed of neurons, so time has to be delayed. In this case, that dilation is just tweaking the perception of time, so no manipulation of physical chronology. At first, I was swimming in total darkness. Then, as Monaco started making sense of the data and feeding me visuals, things started to take shape. The nanites were represented as huge polygons of various colors. Bursts of data between the micro machines looked like groups of small bullet trains zipping back and forth all around me. Step one is confirming Monaco's interpretation of what roles the different nanites are playing and what systems they're interacting with. Laying in color coding helped guide me away from attacking anything that could harm Marzell. To cure a psychovirus, you have to break down its network to make it go inactive. It felt like it took hours, bombarding individual nanites with code to disrupt them, redirecting their communications to cordon off groups of machines to shut them down. It's like dismantling a house of cards and doing a controlled demolition at the same time. Once they were clear of the virus, the memory reintegration process proceeded smoothly. Myself, Monaco, Cam, Cakes, and Didi went to see what all was in the vault. It's not unusual for vaults to require high security levels to be opened, particularly if they're holding information or spoils raided from a sensitive target like Tardata. I didn't expect to go in the military high security lockdown. Extra identity scans, confirmation that not only was I me, but I was the me from that timestamp and from the correct dimension. Genetic sweep, ocular sweep, I mean, they sweeped everything down to my DNA twice. But once I cleared all of those extreme measures, it made sense why 675 took all the extra steps to protect themselves and what was happening in that vault. In addition to the rest of the core elements of the Miami grid map, there were a number of sensitive items in the vault. At that time, 675 already had possession of two of the three control keys for Tardata Tech. Despite the complexity of business dealings, ownership has been kept surprisingly simple. Whoever has the keys is the owner. Hardware, software, and property. The three pillars of modern corporations. 675 had the hardware and the property keys. That's how they were able to build their hiding place without being discovered. But the reason for the extra security had to do with the weapons of mass destruction they had in the vault. Grid rays are our ace in the hole, and one of the weapons we use to end the brick wars. I would like to refute the claim that I or any member of my unit built the grid rays. I will confirm that I took possession of one of the munitions shortly after we discovered them. I have turned over the control ring I had to the investigative team, which will confirm the authenticity of the blockchain command codes, verify the date the devices were made, and show a history of who held the devices and when. I cannot emphasize enough how dangerous these weapons are, both because of their destructiveness, but also because if anyone ever finds out you have one, it will make you a target. A grid ray siphons power from the digital field and uses it to fold space-time in a way that's catastrophic. When detonated, it emits beams of light as part of the targeting before it starts pumping out gravitons that cut through the grid. Unlike nuclear weapons, which can be detected easily and neutralized remotely by the digital field, the core material of a grid ray exists in a state of superposition despite our knowing exactly where it is, what it is, and it can't be targeted by the digital field since it's a non-stable group element. The use of grid rays are highly restricted, not only as part of our pact to end the brick wars, but because their use and manufacture is incredibly dangerous. A grid ray can be used to totally decimate a city or wipe out specific parts of it. It can be set to target biological organisms or leave them completely unharmed. Their proper use requires complex programming, and more than a few people have died in their manufacture. There have been 3 misfires of grid rays to date, which resulted in casualties so great the ramifications almost destroyed our organization as we debated whether we should continue using them. There are a lot of doubts as to whether such technology was even possible. Some people in the cities still don't believe we have these things. The smart ones know we do. During the development, they wanted to test how sophisticated the programming could be. So they targeted a particular silver-infused cotton polyester blend and lit the grid ray up. Shortly thereafter, underwear within 3 miles of the facility molecularly disentangled. Unfortunately, there were no serious injuries, and they proved the viability of the weapon. This happens to be the origin of the static core's idioms about setting underwear on fire while doing research. Cam, Cakes, and I set about tearing down the grid rays, doing so as standard protocol if there is any question about their validity. We had to make sure they hadn't been compromised by Tardata or anyone else. While it's unlikely Tardata would have been able to figure out how to use a grid ray, even if they had gotten their hands on it, we avoid making assumptions with weapons that can wipe out whole cities. We checked the integrity and condition of every component and the programming to ensure they were safe and sound. The service was noted in their maintenance log and is saved in the data file in the control ring, which of course is all that's left of them now. It became clear to everyone that saw those bombs what the path forward was going to be in taking out the wall. It had been built by bending and locking space through all 3 major flexes of the digital field, so the most effective way to take it down was to blast it to atoms and press the space smooth. This both simplified and complicated matters. As soon as we finished rebuilding the bombs and certified them, Pharaoh called to ask if we would volunteer as detonators. We each said yes, since we already committed to seeing the mission through. It was also a matter of pragmatism. Few in the Corps know the technology better than we do. At the time I was asked, my knowledge was purely theoretical. I had built several grid rays, rebuilt several grid rays, but they'd stopped being used long before I came back to life. given the nature of the devices and that there was an active $10 billion bounty, no one can be ordered to detonate a grid ray. That's why we had to volunteer. As a detonator, it was my responsibility to ensure the grid ray was either returned to a secure lockdown facility and controls turned back over to the owner or an appropriate commander, to make sure that the armament is used as intended or ordered, or in the event that a mission is somehow compromised and options one or two weren't possible, to see that the bomb was destroyed to prevent its capture. Up until Control, Alt, Delete, I'd never seen a grid ray go off in person. I don't know that I ever want to see one go off again, and the spectacle of seeing three light up, I'll never forget.